Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. We're back to an actual roundtable. We've got our special guest, Wade McPhail, here. We've asked Wade to put on a collared shirt because as a special guest, we want him to put his best foot forward. He's got a fresh haircut. He's trimmed his beard. It's good. It's nice to have you as a special guest on the podcast that you helped found. It's good to see that you've gotten a reprieve from the warden to be able to step out for your 1 hour of recreation pursuant to Bureau of Prison Policy. So good to see you, Wade. Welcome back to the fold for the day.
Thanks. It's good to be back on the grid.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, listen, I know you've been using the Patriot solar panel system, working off the grid. And of course, we know that in Wisconsin, summer is coming to an end. So you've already started sharpening the blade for your snowblower and are preparing to finish up your mowing for the season. So good to see that. And of course, Matt Kachansky, who has taken the brunt of your absence over the past couple of weeks. So it's good to see that Matt doesn't have to be the full-time whipping boy for the next half hour or so. So Matt, always good to see you.
It's good to be here. It's good to have Wade here so that the whipping marks on my back can start to heal. And I can just peel them off my clothes.
I don't know if I would say it's good to see you, but
it's good to be here.
All right, it's good enough. So today we want to revisit a topic that comes up unbelievably frequently. It is spoken about a lot of our podcasts that we watch, and a lot of our friends in the industry that podcast talk about this, and it's the dreaded Incident 2 rule. Now, we're not going to talk granularly about the Incident 2 rule and how that works, and go into that great detail, other than to say that the incident rule is only applicable in the office setting, meaning generally speaking, place of service 11 on your CMS 1500 form that gets submitted, and it is relegated down to services that are incident to the physician services, and they are typically services that are performed by non-physician practitioners, such as PAs and NPs, and there's no problem with doing that, but there are a bunch of rules that require that. The number one rule is that the provider must be in the office suite and immediately available. And the reason why that's an important piece is there is a wide range of people who have their own personal interpretations of what available means. Available does not mean I'm on the beach in Cabo with my family and I'm available by cell phone. It doesn't mean that FaceTime is available. It means you are physically in the office suite and immediately available. This is why in institutional settings, Incident 2 doesn't exist, because there is no immediately available office suite that you could be in. If you're, for example, sending your PAs or NPs to skilled nursing facilities and things of that sort, it just is not applicable. And so it becomes problematic, because what winds up happening is when you talk to providers who are violating this rule and they say, well, my biller told me I could do this. And the number one thing is that ultimately providers need to always remember that providers are ultimately responsible for the claim that gets submitted, not the biller. And by the way, taking advice from a biller may not be the best course of action. You really should be seeking the advice of professionals who do auditing and coding and things of that sort as a starting point. And then also any payer-related guidelines that are out there. The Incident 2 rule is a well-documented rule. And for the most part, there is a ton of information out there about what is, right and what is wrong about that. But Wade, I want to start with you, because one of the key things that we notice is that when investigators are making requests for records relative to an investigation that they're doing, oftentimes the SIU investigator will write in that letter, sometimes it's even templated, where it says, including but not limited to, and then enumerate a list of things. And I could tell you, I recently had a project I was working on for one of our large Medicaid payer teams, where we had a very large overpayment because a variety of documents were not produced. The auditor was denying the claims because there were some documents that weren't produced. And when we were on a teleconference with the provider said, I gave you everything that you asked for. And we came back and said, yes, but you were missing these documents. And the provider said, but you didn't ask for them. So, of course, we bring up the document and it says, including but not limited to, and that includes it. And the provider's response was, how am I supposed to know what that means? And so that is actually not a bad point to make, and I readily understand that. But from an SIU investigative perspective, this is one of those examples where, and I know we've talked about this before, it's you've got other subject matter experts available, you've got other team members available, and this is one of those things where talking to those people and understanding granularly what documents the auditor would need to do that review and being a little bit of an outside-the-box thinker are really key pieces of that puzzle.
Right. And just to back up a little bit, you hit the main point if we're talking about like an incident two case. The main issue there is, is the physician available? And that, as you said, that doesn't mean you have a phone on you where you can answer a call. There's a lot more required than that. So, and even beyond the like proximity issue, you know, you might look at something where the physician is letting everybody else use their logon credentials, or they're billing new patients as incident two, which you can't do. It has to be an established patient. If there's anything dealing with significant change in plans of care, that can't be an incident two. That has to be the physician. Anything where the physician is not actively involved. So before you start in an SIU situation, before you start to, you know, generate your records requests, you have to step back and really look at what am I trying to prove or disprove. And it could be things beyond just is the physician physically present when this incident to bill was billed as such. So you have to think about, you know, first of all, like you said, specificity. What exactly am I looking for? You can use the catch-all towards the end of it, you know, including but not limited to, but you have to really be diligent about listing every specific record you can think about that you're requesting. And it should be, like you said, outside the box. You don't want to just go through a list of, you know, I want the medical records, I want the discharge report, you can't go buy a checkbox and just ask for those documents, because you'll be missing key items that technically you could say, I asked for this because I said including but not limited to, but as you pointed out, that's not just a catch-all. You have to be very specific. And in thinking outside the box as to what you're trying to prove, it's beyond just medical records. It might be scheduling, it might be calendars, it might be certain types of ledgers. Again, you have to look at what it is you're trying to prove or disprove, and you may need records outside of typical medical records to do that. So you have to,
right,
you know, get with your SME, with the auditor or the CPC that's going to be doing the audit, if the investigator is not going to be physically doing the audit, and have a conversation about what are we trying to show, prove or disprove, and what, think outside the box, what types of records could help us do that beyond the typical, you know, asking for their electronic medical record copy, you know.
Right. So like, for example, in something like an incident two case, you know, getting the schedules is going to be very helpful, because if the provider is attempting to mask who the actual rendering provider was, the internal scheduling documents are going to help to provide that granular information that you need, that backdrop. Now, Wade, the other piece of this too is going to be, this is one of those examples where speaking to the members or the beneficiaries is going to be valuable, right? Because if you have someone who, for example, if they're under the regular care of the provider's office for a chronic condition, hypertension, hyperglycemia, high sugar, you know, whatever it may be, where they're seeing a nurse practitioner or a PA on the regular, that patient is going to be able to tell you that with a fair amount of frequency, and maybe even tell you, well, on this date I went and I saw the PA. How do you know? I have it in my calendar because I make my appointments with the PA or the nurse practitioner, right? So there are going to be some collateral documents out there that you may get as the result of interviewing members. And again, sometimes I know we talk about conversations with members may or may not have probative value, but on something like this, where you're talking about someone with a chronic condition where they're regularly seeing a healthcare provider, that is going to be a value that will help to piece together some of that puzzle.
Right. And even in those conversations, a lot of times they don't, you know, they may not remember the very specific, you know, details of a visit, but they may know, like, if you can establish, is this your primary care physician you've had for years? So you would recognize when it is him or her. And, you know, maybe just the characteristics. I mean, the primary care physician may be an older physician, and the, you know, someone who's doing the incident two services could be a younger nurse practitioner or whatever. But it's easy for them to differentiate. Oh, I know who my doctor is, and it wasn't my doctor. It was, you know, they may not know who it was, but it was somebody other than my doctor. And then you can compare that to the records where it shows, you know, the different systems they may have too, but it's always the doctor signing the medical record as though they performed whatever the service was. And if the member can say, no, it wasn't my doctor, I know Dr. Jones and it wasn't him, it was somebody from his office. So that's very valuable to disprove or, you know, show that it was not him, even though he's the one that's signing the actual medical record.
Right. So, Matt, that gets to the point of, you know, in a lot of these cases, the question becomes, should we talk to the provider? Should we not talk to the provider? And this is one of those instances where once you've gotten a bunch of the documents, these documents are going to really potentially help you with making some of those decisions. Like on these incident two cases, you know, talking to the doctor and saying to the doctor, well, are you always in the office when your NPs and your PAs are in the office? And waiting to see what their answer is, and then maybe seeing if you have a document that either confirms what they've told you or disproves what they've told you. But sometimes it's you don't want to jump the gun on setting your interview.
Right. Agreed. And following up on some of the things Wade just said, you know, sometimes a provider will come back and say, all I need to give you are the medical records. That's all that's all you should have as a plan. That's all you need access to. And that's not true. The plan should have access to any documentation that supports the claim or not. And that includes the schedules and things like that. So if they argue that, that's probably showing you that they don't have the documents to support the claim. But in terms of interviewing the provider, the doctor, there's two schools of thought. One is you do it right away, and then the rest of your investigation is set up to validate or verify what the provider tells you. The other is you gather the documents first. And this is the one I have always followed. It's you have to prepare yourself for these interviews. You're going to have one shot at this provider. So you want to have all the documentation and information at your ready when you interview this person. So you'll have the schedules in hand. You'll have the documentation that the internal documentation versus what they've submitted to the plan, are there differences in them, so that your questions to this provider can be pointed and focused and supported by the documentation that you have. Well, doctor, you say you saw this patient on such and such, and your signature is at the bottom of this progress note, but the schedule shows that you were in Cabo that week. And how do you explain that you were supervising whoever and providing the service in an incident to matter? And it's time. And if you have examples of that, you just keep doing it. You keep showing them this document, this document, this document, until you've shown them that there's a pattern of what, you know, of lack of veracity in their statements and in their claims. And then you can finally get to the real questions for that doctor, which is, how do you explain yourself? How do you explain the difference between the documents and your statements? And that's when the interviews can be impactful, rather than just listening to what they say and then trying to chase the documents later, by which time the doctor may have lawyered up and you have to get in there. Your access to those records are then limited. Access to any member interviews or staff interviews are then limited. They have to be, you know, the council is going to say they represent everybody. So your investigation can be forestalled just because of you jumped the gun and interviewed the doctor too soon. You just have to get that information in front of you ahead of time.
And in that same vein, Matt, you know, the question becomes, what's the right timing? You know, we often get asked, what's the right timing to have that discussion with the provider? Because oftentimes what winds up happening is the first time that there's a conversation with the provider is typically following the receipt of the overpay. Well, typically the first time there's a conversation is after the receipt of the notification of the investigative audit letter. And that may come as the result of a communication with a lawyer or something like that. In other instances, the provider just produces the record, sends them off, and then the next time that there's a conversation, or the first time there's a conversation, is when that overpayment letter is received, if there is an overpayment. And so the question becomes, you know, what's the right timing on that? And, you know, obviously you always want to have a conversation with, particularly if the provider's saying, hey, can we talk about this? Sure, why not? I mean, you don't lose anything by doing it. But I think there's often a time where you want to jump the gun and have that conversation sooner than later. I mean, think about it. If you have an obligation of incident to violation or services not rendered, you have a member who says, I wasn't here, I was out of the country, and they provide documents. Do you have that conversation sooner or do you have it later? Do you go through the machinations of the investigation? You know, obviously, the longer that you take to get your investigation done, there's an ROI issue that comes in. And so, the question always is what's the timing?
I think what you have to do with an investigation, it varies by each investigations. You build a dialogue with the provider and you start with, you know, hey, we're initiating an audit. We need these records. Here's what, you know, here's the list of these records. Do you have any questions? Start the dialogue with the provider then. Don't just send them the request, but you start talking to them at that point so that they get an understanding that you're serious, that you give them a general understanding of what the audit's about, and that you give them an understanding of, these are the things I need to move forward. And then as things start to come up, like a member comes up and says, I wasn't even in the country for this date, maybe you talk to them about that particular instance just to keep the dialogue going. Allow them to call you if they have questions, so that by the time you reach the point of, I've got enough in my pocket to take to this doctor and get a better story of what went on, so I can figure out, you know, exactly who was seeing them and when and what the falsity is in these claims, or whether there is any falsity to the claims, that as soon as possible, then you set that up and it's just part of the ongoing dialogue. Okay, doc, we've had a lot of conversations. You know what this is about. I think it's time we should, you know, we should sit down face to face and talk about these things. And it should just be a natural progression toward that. One of the failures I'm seeing in, you know, some of the SIUs is that they've become rote in their submit their medical record request. They send it to a fax number, maybe just, you know, the right one that's an NPI. They really don't call to say, hey, did you get it? You know, and the next time they hear from the provider is either when they, you know, they get the records, or they don't get the records and they do an overpayment right letter. And by that time, you're behind the eight ball in terms of establishing a good enough relationship with the provider to get them to talk to you openly.
Right. Yeah. And I think that always becomes a challenge. I think, you know, what we see a lot is, there are allegations that come in which you can do a strictly desk-related investigation where it's a mechanical process and you just go through these machinations and come up with what you want. I think, you know, that's where, you know, one of the things I know we're doing is we're doing a lot more with on-site work. We're doing a lot more with drive-by surveillance, you know, with our national team of surveillance investigators and the on-sites. And those are some of those differentiators where you're going to be able to actually get your investigation done faster when you're marshaling some of those resources, you know, to get to where that is. You know, in a way, just to go back to you with kind of our closing thoughts is, investigators are dogs with bones, right? We never want to, we always want to, you know, kind of get to that conclusion. And the biggest challenge is just figuring out when you've come to that natural ending point and just realize, like, okay, I've done everything I can do. And sometimes the challenge is that you have to just stop spinning your wheels because the wheel can't spin anymore.
Yeah, and I think it's safe to say that in all of those cases, it's not like I'm gonna close this one down without any results, and then I'm not gonna have anything to do for the next weeks or months. There's always a backload of cases where, if this one didn't pan out, and again, our goal is to, get to the truth, right? Is this a valid overpayment that needs to be repaid, or is it maybe it was a misbilling? There's circumstances where there's no recovery that's actually due. The case should be closed and you should move on. And if that's the case, there's a whole backlog of cases. You can be assigned a new case the same day and you can start. It's not like there's not going to be work. So you have to look at it like, this one didn't pan out the way that I thought it would. I mean, most of the times when we initiate an investigation, we're supposed to be, fact finders and neutral, but we're not going to open it unless we think there's something there. So we kind of have this hunch that there's something that's going to come out of this. But if that's the case where it's not, move on, start another one. Might be a bigger and better case that's more egregious, whatever. But there's no shortage of work. So that shouldn't really be an issue.
And as, as Matt's favorite music artist, Kenny Rogers says, you have to know when to hold them and when to fold them.
I like his chicken.
Yeah, the roasters.
I don't know about the song.
The roasters. Incident 2 is just one of those things. And I think, more globally, we're talking about anything that involves ancillary services. It's like if you're doing an investigation involving any ancillary service, x-rays, MRIs, radiological. If you're doing an investigation where you're asking to produce copies of the x-ray, what are you going to get? You're going to get a wrist x-ray. Okay, great. But do we know what the medical indication was for that need? You need that E&M visit from the doctor to be able to show that. So it's things like that that help an investigator understand that picture. And that's why, and as we started off talking about this, including your auditors and your subject matter investigative people from your payment integrity side and things like that will go a long way. It may just be another step where you're saying to the auditor, hey, what records would you need specifically so that you can put them in, so that you don't run into a scenario where you're making this kind of all-encompassing, including but not limited to, and then the provider comes back and says, well, I didn't realize that that's what you wanted. I didn't think enough to know that that's what you wanted, which may be a totally, reasonable answer, yeah. To something like that. So it's an interesting issue. The incident 2 thing is a bugaboo. I think a lot of places have a lot of plans we hear talking about just getting rid of the incident 2 rule entirely, because there is a push to getting more nurse practitioners and PAs into the, the healthcare ecosystem. I mean, I think I read a study that said something like 75 or 80, maybe even more percent of routine services could be performed by a non-physician practitioner, right? Most of us, when we go to an urgent care, whether you realize it or not, you're seeing an NP or PA most of the time anyway for those things. And so the question really becomes, is there a distinction? Is there a difference without a distinction? If you saw an MD versus an NP or a PA for some of these routine services, is it really a discernible difference, in that sense? And so, those are just some things that are out there. So it's an interesting topic. I mean, we'll see as time and summer goes. But from the SIU perspective, it's certainly an important piece of the puzzle to think about when you're doing these investigations. Are you getting the right records? Are you getting the right records that you need for that specific need? And is your auditor going to have everything that they need to not ultimately produce a false positive on a response? Nothing worse than having an audit done and then having to reverse that audit later on because additional documents were produced that you should have gotten to begin with. Your ROI plummets. And it sets a really bad precedent, and then it creates provider abrasion, all these collateral things that we have to deal with on a daily basis. So interesting stuff. Wade, good to have you back for today as a special guest. I expect next week, if you're here, you'll be in a shirt and tie or a tuxedo. Each time you're back, I think we need to step it up a level.
top
maybe
hat.
maybe a ball gown or something, a stovepipe hat. I mean, just something. We need to have something that, you know, sets you apart from it to make sure that you really want to be here. Matt, each time, because Matt continues to come, he's actually, I think next week, he's going to wear one of those 1920 style men's bathing suits, or as they like to call them in England, the swimming costume. We'll have him put his swimming costume on.
From the Lou Abbott and Lou Costello collection. Yeah, exactly.
So, as always, good to see you guys. It's good to have the band back together. And again, everybody, we thank you very much for joining us. Our monthly LinkedIn Lives are scheduled out for several months. We've got those going. Of course, the weekly podcast on Spotify and on YouTube. And as always, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you all.